Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature Captain America, The First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts, just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I am Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And we are in all the way in minute 18, and we're continuing the examination, or actually, I guess we're finished with the examination. And Hal, why don't you take us up to speed where we are at this Army Recruiting Center?
All right, we're still in the exam room. So in the examination room, Steve Rogers stands straighter, his voice quiet but clear. Brooklyn. Dr. Abraham Erskine's eyes soften, a faint nod sealing the moment. Congratulations, soldier, he says, his tone carrying the weight of a promise. Erskine stamps Steve enlistment papers with a large 1A rating. The scene shifts abruptly to a cold, cavernous laboratory deep within a Hydra installation, its walls humming with the pulse of machinery. Johann Schmidt, his voice shadowed with ambition, looms over a complex array of equipment. Are you ready, Dr. Zola? He asks, his voice sharp with expectation. Dr. Arnim Zola, a pudgy scientist with nervous energy, adjusts the dial with meticulous care. My machine requires the most delicate calibration, he replies, his words tinged with caution. Forgive me if I seem overcautious. Schmidt's eyes narrow, his patience thin. Are you certain that those conductors of yours can withstand the energy surge long enough for transference? Zola hesitates, his gaze flickering to a strange glowing artifact at the heart of the machine. With this artifact, I am certain of nothing, he admits, his voice low. I fear it may not work at all.
Wow. So, dueling German accents. Yeah.
Yes, three in a row.
One from the north, one from the south.
Yeah. Right. Wow. And our introduction to Dr. Arnim Zola, who is aptly played by Toby Jones. Everything Toby Jones has been in, comedy, drama, right. You know, any kind of adventure, he's so perfect in this role. There's character
so
actors, and he's just this.
I'll get this out of the way up front, because I know we want to talk about the character, but if anybody listening hasn't seen him in Detectorists, just pause this episode. We'll wait and just go binge it all right now. That is one of the most just spectacular, warmly, gently entertaining shows in recent memory.
True. Absolutely. It's one of those ones you can recommend wholeheartedly. And it's like, what do you mean you haven't seen it? Go, as Hal said, go home. You know, stop us right now. Just go over and watch it. And he comes from just such an amazing acting family. His dad was Freddie Jones, who did a star turn for me in The Elephant Man as the Elephant Man's keeper. Beautiful, brilliant. You do comedy roles and just deadly serious roles. And so I think it's definitely a bit of genetics involved in this, because Toby really channels his father's acting energy in these scenes.
Well, he's a heck of an actor. He's perfect for this role. And it struck me as kind of a funny bit of foreshadowing that maybe a comics fan wouldn't get. The first time we see him is a wide angle shot of his face shot through a lens. So his face is big and distorted and round. And that's a lovely nod to his future in the comics and then later on in Captain America, Winter Soldier, as basically a robot face, you know, a disembodied robot face. It's just a blink and you'll miss it. Just, yeah, that's Zola. He's already Zola, even though he's not in the robot body yet, you know. Very cool.
He's a prototypical Jarvis or a... You know, he becomes, see, in Winter Soldier, when we're flashing, we sort of flashback, we see him in that. Is that in the 70s?
He's uploaded into computers from the 70s.
Yeah, you know,
that's the tapes
right,
whirring and whizzing, right, and yeah, you know, the old yeah. IBMs. Somehow yeah. They've managed to scotch enough of those together to, I don't know, equal one, you know, HP Surface Pro or something. Right. But, in the books, in the comic books, Arnim Zola starts out very much like this guy, the MCU counterpart. He's working as a scientist for Nazi Germany, World War II. He's a biochemist and genetic engineer, and he's sort of a slimy, amoral, Nazi mad scientist that Toby Jones just captured wonderfully here. And you know, I was doing a little reading in preparation for this episode, and I was surprised that the Zola character wasn't created in a Marvel Comics until 1977, when Jack Kirby created him. And then he was retconned. He's such a good character that he was all subsequent stories retconned him back into Captain America's history. So we see stories of him in World War II and in the 50s and the 60s. But the Zola himself didn't exist before 1977.
Yeah, he's such a henchman. He's like the ultimate in henching, as
Yeah.
the guy that comes up with stuff, and he's feeding Red Skull's ambitions, and just has to keep coming up with, I keep thinking of the Joker in the 1989 Batman. Where does he get those marvelous
Wonderful
toys?
toys.
And that's Zola's job in this, is to come up with marvelous toys.
Well, there's almost a purity to his single-minded devotion to just exploring neat scientific things. It doesn't matter who it's for. And again, as I say, in the comics, this was all retconned, but just like MCU Zola, comic book Zola worked for Hydra. He cloned Hitler. At the end of the war, he put the Red Skull into suspended animation so he could wake up 25 years later and hassle Captain America again. And speaking of, you know, amoral scientists who are just interested in the tech, in the comics, he had a really interesting kind of Project Paperclip storyline where the Americans brought him over after the war to help develop the nuclear program. So he went from being a Nazi. Top Nazi scientist to being a an American scientist visionary, which is also what happens to him in the movies. He's brought over to, you know, help. I don't know what he does in the MCU. He develops the program that helps them to, you know, guess the future more or less.
Yeah, he goes from being their Nazi to our Nazi. So
Exactly. They're
yeah,
Nazi to our Nazi. Exactly right.
I
Exactly
think
right.
it was in the right stuff. We were talking about the early space race, and just I hope that our German scientists are better than their German scientists.
Yeah, exactly. And
That's so much
the
the case.
strange thing is that he's going to wind up at the same Camp Lehi that Rogers is
Yeah.
headed for. All that activity happens in the same, I mean, I guess that's the Strategic Science Reserve's main base.
Oh, that's true. That's
I'm sure
fascinating.
just broadcast it for everybody, Jim.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm their ruiner of storylines.
So yeah, I think if you watch this movie and just substitute Wernher von Braun for Arnim Zola, I think you get a pretty good, a pretty good beat on what the filmmakers were going for here.
It's like Wernher von Braun as played by Gary Berghoff in a way.
Yeah,
Yeah,
Like
okay.
he's got a little bit of Radar O'Reilly to him, but you know, none of the nicer qualities.
Yeah, and again, we're back in Jersey because we're going to be talking. I mean, he'll be heading for Camp Lehi, which is, I'm assuming, is New Jersey. My assumption on all of these things is that Camp Lehi is a stand-in for Fort Dix, New Jersey, which was a
Oh, sure.
primary induction center, at least on the East Coast. So, and not too far from another New Jersey Army feature called the Picatinny Arsenal, which is where lots of fantastic high explosives and things like that were developed. But really, Jersey.
The unlikely center of the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, I want to put a pin on this particular on this particular base as we come up to, you know, we hear that piano, three octave piano note at the beginning when we see the snowy, you know, we go from the recruitment center to the snowy land. You hear this giant piano note, and that will play a major role in the end of this film. So we just got to keep that in mind, that this is the base. This is his research base, and as this movie is going to progress, I try to follow. Every time I watch this movie, I still can't quite figure out all the different Hydra bases that we're going to be visiting, but I'm pretty sure this is where he retreats. This is the furthest away from the action, and it didn't hit me until a couple of dozen rewatches. I'm a slow learner, but that this is the main base of operation. So it can be a bit confusing when you're watching the movie that it's like, oh no, it's not just one big Hydra base. He's got a bunch of near identical bases with Similar gigantic offices with great window views of the Alps. Or
I took a couple of references away from the Hydra base. First, it's you know, clearly not a James Bond villain kind of layers. It's built into the side of a granite mountain, and I also wondered if they were kind of trying to invoke some of the feel of Hitler's you know, winter garden,
the Eagle's Nest,
the Eagle's Nest, the Orbis Salzburg. And I suspect, I mean, where else are you going to put Nazis except high in mountains?
Yeah. You know, I mean, so many.
And as Jim said, he's got to be away from the action too. He's not just, he doesn't need to just be secure from the Allies, but he needs to be secure from the rest of Germany, because as we know, he's got his own agenda, and, you know, he's got to live up to that, that whole, you know, oh, you think the Nazis are bad. Wait till you see what Red Skull has in mind.
Yeah, and I think they're drawing from other, you know, as you're saying, Brian, the mountainous Nazis that you have to attack from below to get up into the hills like Guns of Navarone or Where Eagles Dare. Something about altitude that makes it just that much scarier.
I kind of half expected to see Julie Andrews and some skinny kids hiking by, you know, right. But not quite.
Climb every mountain.
I'm looking for George Lazenby and Telly Savalas skiing around Piz Gloria. And just if anybody ever finds themselves in Switzerland and you want to go to the coolest place in the world for lunch, Piz Gloria is it. My dad and I went, I was like 20 years ago now. In fact, by the time this airs, it'll be just about exactly 20 years. And take three cable cars or three funiculars to get up to 10,000 feet. But you're at a restaurant that's just perched, truly balanced on the top of an Alp. It's absolutely spectacular.
Order a Lazenburger.
Yes, exactly. There's lots of little Bond references and a little few odds and sods of memorabilia in the basement and things.
I love it.
Wow. I'm trying to figure out there's – the backstory. I mean, we're coming in the middle of things where this is the end of Zola's experiments. So I wish we had, I mean, I guess it's not necessary to this story, but I wish we had more knowing. I'd like to see a little bit of prequel. This could be where an Andor type miniseries could fit in of you know, where Zola was finding out about the Tesseract, how they tracked it up to Norway, what that whole, the Norse legends that brought them to. I did like the fact that we see the same box that he had pulled out of the wall in Norway is there with a little snake head and that ingenious little contraption.
So what's your take on the time frame? You know, we're in Norway, we recover the Tesseract, now we're here, and it's plugged into the machine.
What I was going to say. They don't tell us how much time has passed here.
Right.
Yeah.
And it doesn't strike me. It hasn't been, you know, all that long necessarily. So that makes me curious too. What was, you know, Zola was building this equipment in anticipation of the Tesseract, or, you know, because we know that Red Skull Schmidt had been looking for it for quite a while.
Well, it's a great question. And I don't think it's clear and probably doesn't need to be clear, but I think it's an interesting question. Sort of my internal canon is that Schmidt was working on a lot of this stuff anyway. And then, you know, this limitless power source falls into his hands. And he's like, okay, I know where I can plug this. Now, stuff like the ray guns and stuff, he wouldn't have been able to do without the Tesseract. So I think you're on the right path. I think Schmidt knew the Tesseract was out there somewhere. He was building this stuff in anticipation of getting it. Went out and got it, brought it back, and said, "Here you go, boy. Here's your power source."
Is it, Brian? Is there anything in the comics that mentions what type of energy this is that he's dealing with? I mean, I'm assuming that it, you know, it's more than electrical energy. I don't know if it's some kind of force power or.
God no, you know, in the '60s, Stanley's answer to everything was radioactivity or transistors. that's all you needed to make things happen. So there might have been some later
cosmic rays, maybe.
Maybe in the 90s or 2000s, somebody really delved into it. But as I think we mentioned on another episode, the Tesseract in the comics was actually a device called the Cosmic Cube that had nothing to do with the Infinity Jones or Infinity Gems or Stones or Jones.
We call him Jones from here.
So this was something this was a twist they put on it for the movies of the Tesseract is one of the Infinity Stones and so forth. I found it fascinating the whole time. They never called it the Cosmic Cube, and maybe they just thought that was too silly, but it's the Cosmic Cube, which had a whole different function and purpose and was more or less a magical object. There's no science to the Cosmic Cube. It was just so it could make any wish you wanted come true. And it was the genie in the lamp kind of thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think they had to save that for Doctor Strange. The first time I think they mentioned the word cosmic, I don't think is until we get Benedict Cumberbatch on the line.
Yeah, but no, if it didn't involve transistors or radioactivity, Marvel's out of ideas.
And now you've just got me picturing: what if Bruce Banner, instead of getting bombarded by gamma rays, what if he just ate a small Japanese radio in the 60s? did the transistors do anything for him? Would he become cyborg at that point? Well,
Stan Lee, you read these early comics and they're charming as heck and they're wonderful. Yeah. But Stan Lee's having Iron Man use transistors as like a source of power. Yeah. Like, that's not what a transistor is, but because right. Iron Man's armor has transistors in it, it could just fly all day, It's delightful, but not scientific.
He meant capacitors. That's what. But yeah, I keep thinking that Schmidt's talking about conductors and things. So whatever this blue energy is, you've got conductors. You probably have some kind of insulation from the conductors. And Zola understands whatever this. I'm going back all the way to something like Edgar Rice Burroughs and thinking of the fifth ray, the ninth ray, that it's just some other power, but it acts exactly like electricity, so you can build circuits and things for it.
I think that's right. And also they needed to explain this thing or talk about it in terms that we can understand. We know what amplifiers and conductors and that kind of thing are. So if you say, okay, I'm going to plug this blue box into an amplifier / conductor / whatever, we got a pretty good idea that power is coming out of that and going to do something else.
Well, and they did a nice job, I think, throughout the MCU, or at least with this artifact in particular. As you said, Brian, I think a modern audience would sort of roll their eyes a little bit at, it's a cosmic cube. It's just magic. Don't worry about it. But they give us maybe a little bit more than that, but not enough to really explain it or anything, but I think we've got just enough to say, okay, it's a glowing blue MacGuffin.
And it's the MacGuffin, exactly.
It's got a lot of power, and we can accept that now. Build your machine with it, Zola, and do your worst.
Yeah, and when it's like if you're watching a police procedural, you don't have a police officer pull out a gun and say, "Now, my firing pin is going to ignite the charge that's in the, that's in the casing, and then fire this lead pellet out through the rifled barrel." So, it's just we know that Zola knows what's going on, or he hopes that he knows what's going on, and he said he's certain of nothing. So,
there's a story told about Gene Roddenberry when he was producing Star Trek, the original Star Trek series, that a script came into him, and it was, three pages of how we're going to fly to, another star. And it's all right, batten down the antimatter and do this and do that and go 14 degrees this way. And okay, go that. And Gene crossed out three pages and said, basically Mr. Sulu hit the gas,
Yeah.
And he just said,
one go. Yeah.
And his point was right. In this kind of speculative fiction, this kind of weird stuff, those people know how this stuff works, so they don't explain it to each other.
Yeah,
they just say go warp two,
Right,
and they don't need to. Somewhere, maybe down in engineering, they're talking to each other like that. But we don't do that on the bridge. We just want to go, and we go, and the audience accepts it as the process. And I think that's a wonderful insight into fictional storytelling. And I think it's something that, to some extent, future Star Trek series kind of forgot. They enjoyed, loved the techno babble, but stories aren't about techno babble; they're about the characters.
Amen to that.
Yeah. And I think this kind of really shows, we're always blowing sunshine about Joe Johnston, but Joe has a real economy with this kind of stuff. You can accept that everybody knows what they're doing when you're watching this particular scene. I think that carries through, and I wish, as we're recording this, they're getting into whatever phase we're in of the MCU. And I'm hoping that whatever they're going to be doing with the future episodes of, as they're getting in with the Fantastic Four and Doctor Doom and things like that, that they carry that through, that you don't need to explain everything or show everything, that let the characters be themselves.
Yeah.
I think anytime somebody feels that tendency, then you just go back and watch, was it the first or second Austin Powers film when you had a character named Basil Exposition?
Yes, exactly.
Who was just there explaining everything. I think that was a wonderful jab at that kind of thinking and a good reminder.
The second film where he said, you know, I was talking about time travel and he goes, oh my gosh, I've gone cross-eyed. He goes, well, you shouldn't think about it. And then Michael York turns directly to the camera and said, and neither should you.
Should you, yes. So, exactly.
Yeah. Just repeat to yourself, it's just a show. I should it's really just react. Show.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Wow. Well, on that note, this has been quite a minute.
It's just a show, Jim.
It is just a show.
To our listeners, just react.
Yeah, yeah. It's fun, but we have many more, and you know, I realize this was a host only episode, of which we have several times, but we have some interesting guests coming up, so please stay tuned. Also, I would like to thank our audience. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like the show, don't forget to subscribe. Please leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, it helps us if you do a review. Apple Podcasts, the more reviews you have, the further apparently you get moved up in the rankings on their front page. So we really appreciate a review of all those 5 stars. Just keep going with as many stars as they have on the screen. But thank you for that. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.